Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hi, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome back to our Coastal Command Cold War series. The Shackleton replacement now started to become more urgent. For years, the Air Staff and Ministries had argued over what type should replace the Shackleton, including variants of the Vulcan, Britannia, VC Den, and Trident, before settling on the Nimrod in 1964. We return to Chris Gibson, author of the brilliant book Nimrod's Genesis, to learn how the process unfolded.
The original idea was to have a replacement in service by at least 1965, and that was a requirement OR350.
Yeah, that's right.
And just about every aircraft manufacturer in Britain that built anything bigger than a Viscount, well, an HS-748, produced a design study for a maritime patrol aircraft. Some of them were quite exotic, shall we say. Hanley Page, they were developing a laminar flow flying wing called the HB-117, which was a massive airliner come transport, and it was tendered. At the other extreme, Hawker Siddeley proposed the DH-1011, which was a transonic variable geometry airliner converted into a maritime patrol aircraft. And their rationale...
These were really advanced.
Oh, yeah.
Really advanced technology for the day, wasn't it? I mean, some of the stuff that you look at there is the sorts of concepts we're starting to see now.
Yeah. Well, we haven't really seen a true laminar flow control airliner yet. And that is something I would like to
see. But everyone talks about it, yeah.
Oh, they all talk about it.
Yeah.
Same with the supersonic airliners. They've been and gone. So
yeah. And there were supersonic aircraft proposed for the Shackleton replacement as well, weren't there?
Yeah. Yeah. The idea was that you could get to your patrol area much faster. And because Soviet submarines at that time had to surface to launch their weapons, their ballistic missiles, if you picked up a Soviet submarine on the surface, you could accelerate supersonic speed and reach it before it had time to submerge and hit it with, whatever weapon you fancied hitting it with. And that was the idea of the supersonic maritime patrol.
And we talked earlier about the evolution of the Soviet submarines that the Coastal Command, or Strike Command as it was becoming at the time, was required to find and destroy. And that led to, as you mentioned, OR-350. OR, by the way, is that operational requirement?
Operational requirement. You'll also see it written as Air Staff Requirement.
Right, okay.
Basically the same thing.
Yeah. So we started off with 350, the Shackleton replacement. How did that unfold? Because it became quite a traumatic process, didn't it? The whole process of looking for a replacement.
There were so many proposals that I think their staff just said, stop, let's, enough of this, we'll have to re-examine this. The threat's changing so much, we need to look at this and reissue it. And they reissued it as OR-357. But in the meantime, they'd been looking at saving money. And one of the ways they wanted to save money was to combine roles in a single aircraft type. And this acquired the name Trinity 3-in-1. And the three roles were maritime patrol, ballistic missile carrier, carrying Skybolt air-launched ballistic missiles, and troop transport.
Yeah.
Various designs were proposed for this, including the Hawker Siddeley 10-11, which had by this time evolved into the 10-23, which is a three-engine version. Still transonic, swing-wing aircraft. Other types were the HP 117 laminar flow type and the VC-10. Now, the VC-10 crops up time and time again in the story of the
maritime control
aircraft, right into the 80s.
But
the problem with these were that
I could have seen it though, Chris. I could have seen a VC-10 in that role.
I do like them.
four engines, rear mounted. It had all the potential for being a great maritime patrol aircraft.
The problem was it was too big, too expensive. And the air staff reckoned that a three-role aircraft, it would never be configured for the role you needed it when you needed it. Every role would be compromised in some way. And because it was a big aircraft, it would be really expensive to operate. And that was the end of that. And
But there, as you say, there were multiple VC-10 variants. But it seems to me that there were, and Avro also proposed a Vulcan maritime reconnaissance version as well, which I thought was quite interesting.
That was for OR-350 as well. It was based on a transport version of the Vulcan. But
and the other thing you had at the other end of the spectrum was aircraft that were too engined and too small and didn't have the capability. So, you know, the Avro, the 748 variants, and the Bridgie Atlantique seems to have been a common theme right from post-war, through the whole of the Cold War. I was genuinely surprised about that.
Well, much to the French listeners' chagrin, I suppose, Avro had a big part to play in the Atlantic, particularly the structure of how it was built. And Avro were keen to see the Atlantic in service. It had originally been developed for NATO basic military requirement number 2, which was an idea that every NATO country would use the same aircraft type for whatever role. There was at least 22 of these NBMRs. But the idea never really caught on, particularly with the British, who wanted nothing to do with NMBR2, and definitely nothing to do with the Atlantic, because it was French. One of the designs for OR-350 that I find particularly interesting was a derivative of the de Havilland Trident airliner, which Avro took, and they called it the Avro 776, and it was a nice, handsome-looking beast. Avro fitted a new, more efficient wing, more efficient for cruising, but they kept the three-engine configuration of the Trident, and that ultimately became the air staff's preference for OR-350, this Avro 776, which was, as I say, a nice-looking machine. And it would later go on into OR-357, which was the next stage after the air staff had enough of OR-350. And again, the 776 won that process.
And Chris, even though it was three-engined, given what we'd previously said about the air staff making heavy demands on a four-engined aircraft?
Well, they seem to be quite happy with three engines, because some of the other proposals for OR-350, including one based on the Atlantic, had three engines. It had a Rolls-Royce Spey in the tail, and one of these Atlantics was also to be a ballistic missile carrier. So they were happy with three, as long as it had more than two. That seems to have been the case.
And as you said, the Atlantic resurfaced, but so again did the American requirement, because the P3, the Orion, was also seen as a potential option for 357 as well, wasn't it?
Well, 357 was a much more technologically demanding requirement than OR350. The air staff had seen how far technology had advanced in the few years between the two, and they issued that in June 1963. And it was challenging, but again, the Avro 776 came to the top, saw off various things, including the Orion, which was in service with the American Navy, and a Hercules-based maritime patrol aircraft, which the problem with these, the tactical transport-based versions of proposals for these requirements was that the fuselages were too big, very draggy, they had a lot of wasted space within them, and the air staff wisely said we should stick with a fairly slim fuselage size, cabin size, what would normally be in an airliner, 6 seats abreast. That was ideal, and Avro had done an awful lot of work for OR357 to decide and identify the best airframes for such applications as maritime patrol. And they also came down to an airliner-sized cabin.
Okay, and one of the interesting aircraft, as well as the Trident from the British stable, shall we say, was what later became the BAC 111, but the BAC 1011?
The BAC 1011 was it was proposed for the later OR381, which we'll come to later. But it was a bizarre hybrid of VC-10 outer wings, BAC-111 forward fuselage, BAC-111 rear fuselage, and a new center section, but with engines, VC-10 style, four in the tail. And it was quite a handsome-looking machine, but I don't think they'd much hope for it, really. By that time, they were throwing everything at it.
Yeah, it's just bizarre reading through the story of all the aircraft types that they were looking at, considering. It genuinely looked like a bit of a free-for-all. But politics drives most decisions, as we say. And as you mentioned there, the requirement was changed yet again. Why is it, Chris, that there became so many operational requirements, but the reality is they didn't ever really make a decision until much later in the process?
The chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you will be aware of the TSR2, HS681, and the P1154. These three types were cancelled in 1965 by the incoming Labour government because they identified them as being far too expensive and basically a quantum leap that we could not take in aviation technology. Now, that's going to annoy a lot of people, but one of the victims of that same process was OR357. It was looking like being very expensive, and it was going to take a long time to develop, and the Shackletons needed to be replaced pretty much as soon as possible. So the air staff reluctantly cancelled OR357. And at this point, the Ministry of Aviation became involved, and they said, right, we're just going to buy the Brigg Atlantic, and even if it's going to have French labels in the cockpit, it'll be cheap and we'll have it and it's available. That's what we're going to have. And they wrote OR381 around the Atlantic. And as you can imagine, a lot of people got very annoyed by this, basically, surrender to the French, as they saw it. One of the personalities that got very exercised with this was Sir Arnold Hall. Now, Arnold Hall had been the chief of the Royal Aircraft, director of the Royal Aircraft Establishment until 1955, then became technical director at Hawker Siddeley Aviation. And he was most miffed that it was not going to be a British design that was selected for OR-381, purely because it had been drawn up around the Atlantic. And his argument was that all the targets for these operational requirements had been very, very challenging. The Atlantic had never come near meeting them. So why was the air staff selecting this design when it so obviously did not meet the requirements up until they effectively moved the goalposts? And Arnold Hall asked for a meeting at the ministry, and it sounds like he banged on the desk and read the Riot Act, and he basically said, I can give you a jet-powered maritime patrol aircraft for the same price you'll pay for your 50 Atlantics. And whether the ministry called their bluff or saw sense, don't know. But they said, right, show us what you can do. So Arnold Hall issued the instructions, sort this out, and Hawker Siddeley rose to the challenge, and they produced what was at the time called the Maritime Comet. The one thing to remember about the Comet was that it was a late war design, effectively, and actually a younger design than the Shackleton. So this was pointed out by a lot of people, but Hall and Hawker Siddeley would have none of it. They basically redesigned the Comet as a maritime patrol aircraft. They've put new Spey engines in it for fuel efficiency, extend endurance. They didn't want to puncture the pressure cabin of the Comet. So, well, Comets get previous for such things.
Yeah.
So they added a ventral panel that pretty much covered the entire underside of the aircraft. And that's where the weapons and the radar were installed. And the Maritime Comet became the Hawker Siddeley HS-801.
And, I mean, we'll come to the name in a minute, because name and colour seem to have been another interesting development. But at this time, Chris, were the other airframes that were in the mix completely ruled out? Did the Comet variant then become the front runner?
It did, but there were two main airframe companies in the UK at that time, British Aircraft Corporation, BAC, and Hawker Siddeley. And Hawker Siddeley obviously had the lead with the Maritime Comet, but BAC, in response to OR-381 being issued, also annoyed that the French had been given the contract, they came up with two designs, the VC-10 Maritime, which had already been dismissed as too big and too expensive. And in response to that accusation, they merged the VC-10 and the BAC-111 to produce the BAC-1011 that we discussed earlier. But really, there was nothing could come near to the speed of development required to meet OR-381 and replace the Shackletons in a timely manner, apart from the Maritime Comet. So on it came.
And Chris, in terms of technology and anti-submarine warfare capability, we mentioned previously computing power and that sort of thing. How much of a step change was the Maritime Comet and the technology at that point becoming? Because we all recognize the capabilities of the Nimrod as it became. Was there a massive step change in the technology that they were proposing to go into the Maritime Comet?
Not really. It's been accused of being a jet-powered Shackleton using the same equipment, but it did have a lot of improvements. It wasn't the full OR-357 systems that the air staff wanted, but it has to be remembered that the Maritime Comet was really an interim type pending development of the OR-357 to its full extent. They basically bought time with the Nimrod, and it was only supposed to be in service for a short time. But we know that didn't happen. It remained in service. And eventually, around about 1969-70, when the Maritime Comet was ready for service, the air staff was actually looking at upgrading its systems to pretty much the full OR-357 capability. Weapon systems,
right.
New radar, etc., etc. And
okay. And did that result in another requirement, or was it an upgrade to the Maritime Comet they were talking about? Is this in effect going from MR1 to MR2?
That was what happened. The MR1 was no slouch. I mean, within 3 years of it entering service, it had won the Fincastle Trophy 4 years in the trot. It won it 17 times in the duration of that type's involvement in that trophy. That's good.
Yeah, I think it's got one of the best records ever, hasn't it, for that award?
Yes. That was good. Good stuff. But
swept the floor.
By 1975, the air staff had worked up a specification for an upgrade to the Nimrod. Specification MR, Maritime Reconnaissance, 286. And in conjunction with that specification, they issued a load of requirements for a new radar, a new navigation system, new acoustic processors, which was the computers that we mentioned earlier, new sonar buoys, new electronic support measures, and a new MAD system. So it was pretty much, they had been working on all this stuff since the OR-357 days, but they had to update the Maritime Comet to become the Nimrod MR2. Now, you mentioned a name earlier.
Yeah, what's in a name? Because it was called the Maritime Comet, but that was not going to be allowed to progress, was it?
Yeah, it was called the Maritime Comet pretty much because that's what the journalists had called it. And Avro started referring to it as the Maritime Comet. But the air staff hated that name with a passion. And the diktat came out that they had to have a new name for this machine. And there was about 40 different suggestions for a name, and somebody must have been running a book on it, because one of the earliest names was Nimrod, and after all the to-ing and fro-ing over about 6 months, they had a deadline for naming the aircraft, because it had to be named by the time of the first flight, which... Yep. Apparently, it was an RAF convention that I don't know why they still do that, but it doesn't look like it. But a lot of the names were quite bizarre. There was, to continue the Shackleton vein, the Scott after Robert Falcon Scott, the explorer, that was suggested, dismissed. Some suggested it should be called after. Old coastal command bases like Carl Schott, etc., or former commanders of coastal command like Bo Hill. But at the end, Nimrod was selected because it was a mighty hunter, and the capabilities that this new machine would provide would be those of a mighty hunter. So the word went out.
And before we... leave that interesting challenge. Colour was also, by the way, is a fabulous chapter in the book about the names. You've got to read it. But colour also became a really hot discussion point within the air staff about what colour the aircraft should be. I mean, goodness me, it was almost laughable.
Yes, well, they are... Generally, maritime patrol aircraft were blue. But during the war, they had been grey and white. And if you look at a seagull, you'll see that they are grey and white. And it's all down to shading and blending into the sky. And it's actually really effective. So a senior officer, who apparently had got to the point in his career where he only ever saw aircraft on inspections, decreed that the Nimrods would be white. And it was argued that because they were fairly low to the ground, because of the ventral pannier, they would get very dirty. So he compromised and, okay, you can make it grey in the bottom, but white in the top. And the arguments go back and forward. And I don't know what this officer would make of the current plans for aircraft colours, because they're all grey. Starting to sound like Boris Johnson here. why is it grey? So, but that's the story of the colour scheme.
Yeah, interesting. So tell us about the service of the Nimrod. How did it deliver in service?
Very well. It won the Fincastle Trophy numerous occasions. But I think it's probably its finest hour would be in the Falklands when that blew up in April 1982. Operations in the South Atlantic needed A, anti-submarine cover, and B, search and rescue cover. And the Nimrod was the only machine that could provide that. Unfortunately, it didn't have the range. Even though it had been designed to have long endurance, it didn't have the endurance, have the range to reach the South Atlantic Theatre. So there was a rush to fit it with in-flight refueling probes, which would ultimately lead to a few problems in the future, one of which was crew fatigue, because the missions got longer and longer, and it didn't really have the facilities for like two crews or the toilets were a problem because they only had one Elsa.
As they always are.
Yeah. And 18 hours with like 12 guys. Difficult.
Yeah.
But I would say it's done everything it was asked to do. I don't think there's anything that Nimrod has failed at. Never.
The rush to install air-to-air refueling capabilities, though, ultimately became an element of its eventual downfall with the loss of XV-230.
Yeah, well, that's really, the Nimrod should have been replaced long before that. They should have been replaced in the mid-90s, and that was the plan. But they were run on for various reasons, probably involving money as ever. And it was operating, XVE-230 was operating in basically an ELINT and communications relay role over the mountains of Afghanistan. And it had completed an in-flight refueling routine operation, carried on with its mission. And a fire broke out on board and the aircraft exploded, with this sad loss of the entire crew. And in the subsequent inquiry, inquest actually, because of the deaths, the coroner who's in charge of inquests in the UK was scathing in his comments, basically said that the aircraft was not fit for purpose, unflyable. And this in turn led to what they call the Haddon Cave Review, carried out by a barrister. And this review revealed, quote, a catalogue of failures in the oversight of the various Nimrod modifications, which included the in-flight refueling equipment installation, which and its safety was affected by an earlier modification to a heat transfer channel in the lower fuselage. But at the end of the day, the MOD admitted that XV-230 was not airworthy at the time, and from March 2009, all the Nimrods that hadn't received a specific safety enhancement were grounded, and that was the end of routine Nimrod operations.
And of course, we saw the eventual scrapping of all the latest version airframes because there was a later development, wasn't there? Tell us about the last evolution of the Nimrod, the MR4. For those youngsters that don't know the story.
Right. It's quite horrific, actually. The Nimrod's required replacement from the mid-1990s. So the air staff drew up staff requirement air 420 for a replacement for the Nimrod. There were a number of proposals, including the new American anti-submarine aircraft, the P-7, the Lockheed P-7. And that's what they selected. They say, well, if the Yanks are having it, we'll have it. And that's what the RAF is going to get, these Lockheed P-7s. However, the American government cancelled the P-7, which left the British in the lurch again. And they started looking for a replacement, a home-built replacement. And eventually decided on a reworked Nimrod with new engines and new systems, etc., etc. And they were going to take existing Nimrod airframes, put a new wing center section and inboard engine bays, and basically re-engine the Nimrod and fit new kit. They soon discovered, when they started to take them apart, that there was various problems with the airframes. I won't go into the intricacies because it ends up in an argument. There's various theories about why they were like this.
Yeah.
But I do recall I was at the Avro Heritage at Woodford, and George Jench, one of the archivists, he says, "Ah, let's go for a cup of tea. I'll show you my comets." And I went, "Oh," thinking he was going to show me some models of comets. But no, we walked into this massive hangar, and there were all these comets, and they were basically the Nimrods with the panniers and the wings removed, and they were just sitting there. It was an amazing sight, and there must be photographs somewhere because, you're not allowed cameras in places like that.
Yeah.
But the trials and tribulations of the what became the Nimrod MRA-4 are numerous. I spoke to one test pilot who said it was the worst aircraft he'd ever flown. He reckoned it was unflyable, but eventually. The number, I'm not sure what the driver for reducing the number in the order was, but the initial order was for over 20, and that was soon reduced to 8 or 9 at the end of the program. Whether that was because they couldn't get the airframes to refurb, or they ran out of money, not sure. But the first MRA-4 flew in September 2009, but a year later the entire program was scrapped. And all that remains of it is some brochures and stickers. And I've got a little souvenir coin that I got at Woodford. And an almost £4 billion programme was reduced to £1 million worth of scrap, which is shocking. And in the end, eventually, Britain was left with no maritime patrol capability for a long period. I think it was about 5 years before the Boeing P-8 Poseidon was procured without any competition. It was just bought. And that's what we have today. And I'm sure it's very good.
So, Chris, just in summary, from Coastal Command post-World War II to Strike Command at the end of the Cold War and the scrapping of Nimrod MR4. How would you look back on Cold War Coastal Command, its aircraft, its heritage, and its legacy?
I would say it's probably one of the most successful arms that the RAF has ever had. It's risen to every challenge that's been placed. It's done everything that's been asked for it. Nimrods especially, they had a long career in the RAF, and they did everything that was asked of them. When I worked offshore, it was quite comforting to know that if you got in trouble, there'd be a Nimrod there within half an hour, in charge, looking after you, coordinating any rescue that was required. And it did do that during the Piper Alpha disaster. One of the many massive search and rescue operations that Nimrod was involved with. And I think it's a great aircraft. I won't hear a bad word against it. Not even the AEW.
So, Chris, in summary, the book, of course, that we've based most of this talk on is Nimrod's Genesis, RAF Maritime Patrol Projects and Weapons Since 1945. My best read recently. Absolutely loved the book. Where can we find a copy of it? Where can listeners get hold of this and read in more detail all the things we've talked about over the last couple of episodes?
It's available from Cressy Publishing, and it's also available from my good mate Simon Watson at the Aviation Book Club book shop in Tunbridge Wells, and I'm sure all the good aviation bookshops will have copies.
Yeah, we'll even have a copy on our own bookshop. So we'll put links to Cressy, to Simon, and to our bookshop in the show notes for this. Chris, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for all of your time and helping us understand Coastal Command in the Cold War.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
I can't recommend Chris's book enough. That is, of course, Nimrod's Genesis. It's big, has masses of photos and graphics, and is full of excellent detail on the whole post-war maritime Cold War aircraft and operations in RAF service. Okay, in our next chapter, we turn our attention towards a Nimrod restoration in the form of the Maid of Moray, which still ground runs on the superb Yorkshire Air Museum Thunder Days. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music and the Aviation Historian for their support. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at NASCOT Hornet on all the social media feeds, as well as the rest of the extended team, Gareth, Tim and Ellie, across all of the extended social media portals. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Stay tuned to hear our next chapter of the Cold War Coastal Command story on Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.